Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, Free Markets, the Fiera Series. In this series, you may recall, we have occasionally met very brave intellectuals. We've often met authors who write about freedom, who believe in it deeply, but we've also met some courageous people who have been willing to risk their life in the service of spreading the gospel of freedom, so to speak. People like Tom Palmer, a previous guest, who did risk his life indeed behind the Iron Curtain in Eastern Europe and in the Middle East to spread the message of freedom. Well, you're going to meet just such a courageous defender of freedom today. His name is Luis Enrique Ball. He is Latin American, and he has two topics to comment on, Cuba and Venezuela. He's the publisher of the Pan Am Post, and as you will hear, he does not mince words. Here is Luis Enrique Ball, whom I met in Manhattan. Luis Enrique Ball, I'm going to read from an article you wrote that has a very striking title, You Will Not Like Cuba. That's the title you put on, and that'll be self-explanatory in a moment. I'm going to quote. During the early days after the fall of the Berlin Wall, several national media outlets in the United States published articles referring to East Germany as the most advanced of the Eastern European economies, possessing advanced industries in optics and a high productive workforce. Soon afterwards, it became clear that the authors of these articles had foolishly believed the lies spread by communist East Germany's vaunted propaganda machine. And your article goes on to explain that, in fact, the optics factories were no good. All the economic miracles that East Germany had supposedly achieved were no good. And you go on to say, you use that as a template to say, when we finally get a good close look at Cuba, we'll see that it's not a miracle of social justice. It's not a miracle of modern medicine. It's a sham. It's a Potemkin village.
Absolutely. I think the as I point out in that article, I think some in the press are making the same mistake they did with East Germany. As you know, East Germany, it turned out to be one of the biggest dumps, waste dumps in the world. I mean, there was an environmental crisis once the West Germans came in and saw what was going on. Cuba is the same. This vaunted medical system. Actually, we at the Pan Am Post, we did an expose. We had one of our reporters went into a Cuban hospital, not the ones where they take Hollywood celebrities. Yeah. But the hospitals where actually the Cuban people go on a daily basis. And we had an article, a series of articles on that, how Cubans have to take everything from their sheetings to, pillows and even some of the basic, even medicines to the hospital so they are treated at the hospital in Cuba.
It's a do-it-yourself hospital.
It's a do-it-yourself. And the hospital has the surgeons. And the hospital has the operating room, but actually the patients are bringing many of the supplies. Even the food they are given, if you're hospitalized in your average Cuban hospital, you have to bring your own food or the food for your relatives who are interned in the hospital. So Cuba is, when I see these magazines, for example, here in New York on the stands, you see these magazines that, what to wear on my next visit to Cuba, and this kind of articles. I'm amazed as to the ignorance of what the people are going to find in Cuba. Yes, there are a few Western hotels, quality hotels. There are a few, and there's a couple of streets in Havana that are worth visiting. But Cuba is a country in ruin. Well, you're not going to find the Havana of Hemingway or of Fred Astaire in the old Fred Astaire movies. What you're going to find is a city in ruins. And you're going to find one of the poorest countries on earth.
Poorer than Haiti.
Poorer than Haiti. And because, of course, the Cuban statistics are fake, just like the East German statistics were fake. And additionally, Cuba doesn't produce anything. Haiti produces some things. Cuba does not produce anything other than just a few cigars.
And rum.
And rum in very little quantities. And with imported sugar, by the way. Mm-hmm. They are actually importing the sugar from which they make the rum.
Yet they used to have the greatest sugar harvest in the world, as I recall, La Cosecha.
Yeah, they used to have the biggest. They used to be number one country exporter of sugar in the world. Cuba doesn't produce anything. What they're doing is they're receiving a subsidy from Venezuela so they can buy the goods that their people are consuming. And the goods are rationed. That's the other thing. The tourist who's reading these magazines, these travel magazines, as if Cuba is the next great destination, will be surprised that there are no toy stores in Cuba. There are no supermarkets in Cuba. There is no clothing stores to speak of in Cuba.
No car dealerships.
No, of course, no car dealerships. So Cuba is a country completely in ruins and without the ability, while they still are in a communist society. As I mentioned in that article, Cuba is not visiting. Visiting Cuba is not visiting East Germany after the fall of the wall. Visiting Cuba is visiting the country, or visiting is the equivalent of visiting East Germany before the fall of the wall. Mm. The communists are very much in power. The secret police is very much active. Nothing has changed in Cuba. The only thing that has changed is that the United States government has decided to establish relations. But there has been not one iota of change in the regime. So that's very different from, let's say, saying we're going to visit Prague or East Berlin in 1990. By that time, the regime had changed. Nothing has changed in Cuba.
And I remember when I studied in Germany, we'd go up to East Germany, and the East Germans would openly laugh at their regime, and they'd laugh at their aluminum money that floated on a glass of beer. And they made no bones about it. And when you went to a restaurant, you could ask the waiter, okay, what dish do you really have? And he'd say, well, take dish number 4. That's all we've got. So if Cuba's like that, then it's very much still a Potemkin village.
Absolutely. Well, not even a Potemkin village, because they haven't been able to hide much of the decay that is going on. It's going to be evident, or it is evident for anybody who goes there, mm-hmm. the great decay of one of the most beautiful and historic cities in the Western Hemisphere. Havana has a 500-year-old history, and it used to be one of the great, truly great cities of the world. There are many books written about how Havana was literally, with Buenos Aires, were probably one of the two greatest cities in the Spanish-speaking world. What you're going to find is a city in ruins. And in terms of the currency, the average Cuban person pays with the Cuban peso, which is a worthless piece of currency. The paper is worth more than the currency. And, of course, the party members and those who are good to the regime, they get another type of currency with which they can buy imported goods at special stores for party members.
And what's astounding to me as well is the rate of imprisonment. I remember reading a statistic years ago, it may no longer be current, and it was from a human rights organization, saying that Cuba per capita imprisoned more of its citizens, especially for ideological reasons, than even Russia, China, or America per capita. And the number of prisoners was actually staggering.
Actually, I was surprised reading a recent article on Time magazine about Cuba. One of the features that they mentioned about Cuba is how safe it was for the tourists. And I said, I can't believe I'm reading this in Time magazine, because you could have said the same thing about Stalin's Russia. And you can probably say the same thing about North Korea today. The reason why it's so safe is because the prisons are so full.
Yeah, you don't want to be a criminal there.
You don't want to be a criminal there.
They know how to deal with you.
Yeah.
But one thing I found fascinating in your article is that you describe a kind of desperation. Cuba does not produce much, and it is open for business, for tourism. Okay, we Canadians have been going for a long time, and they want more, especially from America. But you describe a society where the Castro brothers are sort of pushing the deadline away, the day of reckoning when people will realize the mess they've made, and they're hoping that lots of new tourism from the U.S. will kind of balance that out. Is that hope well-grounded?
I don't think the hope is well-grounded. I think Americans, they're trying to get a big numbers of Americans, and initially I think they will be successful in getting, once the travel restrictions are lifted, as the Obama administration wants to do, initially they'll get a large number of tourists. But once the tourists, the same thing happened when the Europeans started traveling to Cuba mm-hmm. back some 20 years ago, when Cuba started to allow and promote tourism from Canada and Europe. Initially, there was great interest. And, for example, the people from Spain, the Spanish, flocked to Cuba initially. Mm-hmm. And then they realized it was not fun. It is not fun when you have a cabaret that is only for the foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
It is not fun when you know the shops that you go to, again, is only for the tourists. You are not actually being exposed to the culture. And it's not fun for you to be having fun and spending all this money and have these people, you know, everyone around you with such hardship. So what happened is the expected boom of European tourism in Cuba never materialized. And probably that's kind of the same thing is going to happen with Americans, although the American market is so big.
And it's closer.
Then it's probably going to have an important effect for the Cuban regime in terms of income.
And perhaps they're this is something you bring up, an intriguing thing. Perhaps they're dreaming of a Vietnamese scenario. We forget about Vietnam a little bit because it's not Russia and China. It's not front and center anymore. But it's a country with a free market on the one hand, open to foreign capital, and yet very much still a communist country that oppresses its citizens well, so to speak. So they've found some kind of balance there. The Cubans may be dreaming of that.
Well, it could be, but Cuba hasn't even reached that point, or even close. For example, foreign companies in Vietnam can hire their own people and pay the wages they think should be paid, mm-hmm. employees should be paid. In Cuba, any foreign company that's operating in Cuba has to pay the government a set amount for the number of people that the government provides to that foreign uh-huh. investor. And what happens is, let's say you're paying, let's say, $100 a week to somebody. Actually, the employee gets $5 a week. The other $95 go to the Cuban government.
Mm-hmm.
So Cuba has not even reached the point of Vietnam where you can just, let's go and set up a clothing factory and some American company decides how much the labor should cost. They haven't even reached that point. The opening is not even remotely close to that of Vietnam.
Is there such a thing, however, as Cuba fatigue, let's call it? There has been historically, from Florida outwards, a very strong movement of resistance to the Castro regime by expatriates. But nowadays, most Cuban Americans didn't flee Cuba, weren't born in Cuba. They were born in America. And you get the sense that over time, that energy has dissipated a bit, and people are tired of combating the regime and denouncing it. And Cuba fatigue has set in. Maybe the Cuban regime, to some extent, is counting on that.
Yeah, part of it is that, and part of it is the fact that because you go to Cuba, it's a tropical country in the Caribbean. You know, you have the palm trees, everything is so nice. The people are naturally friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And so people, you don't see the Cuban regime as being as despotic as that of North Korea.
No, obviously, yeah.
But it is. At the end, you have the spies in every block of the street. You have the one of the world's best secret police in place. You said you have one of the, probably the world's largest, highest incarceration rate.
Yeah.
So that's not actually noticeable to somebody who's not really researching what's going on in Cuba. And so you go to this place with these beautiful beaches, you know, these great people, and you would think that the regime is not as bad. But it's the Cuban regime has been very good at, let's say, being subtle in terms of the image it projects.
And it's so close, Cuba, you have to wonder, after all, you know, Vietnam is remote. North Korea is remote, but Cuba's right there. Even if the Americans don't come in the numbers that the Castro brothers would like or spend as many dollars as they hope they'll spend, with that influx, it's going to be very hard to keep the people ignorant of what's on the other side of the water. It's so close.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But I think most Cubans are not ignorant of what's going on. I mean, they're living in droves to the United States, so they know that life is better.
Mm-hmm.
And also because of the Cuban exiles that have been traveling back and forth the last few years, they know that, you know, what they're missing. When you see a baseball player defecting, these are from very humble homes, some of these baseball players.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they interview them, they said, no, we left because we know the kind of life we could have outside of Cuba. So Cubans, have more information than somebody in Vietnam or North Korea would have about the other side. And that's always been part of the problem that the regime has. And that's why the regime has been so adamant in trying to stop the flow of people into the United States.
And now we're going to go to a very related and yet very different topic, which is Venezuela. I'll get to that in a moment. But first, Russia used to save Cuba's backside. We all know that, and it's been historically proven. Didn't Venezuela pick up the slack and save Cuba's backside?
Oh, absolutely. Still is. It still is. Venezuela is sending over $100,000 of 100,000 barrels of oil a day to Cuba, not for Cuba's internal needs. Those $100,000 are sold at a very subsidized price, almost given for free to Cuba, for Cuba to resell.
To have actually, hard currency.
The main source of hard currency for Cuba today is the resale of Venezuelan oil.
And which leads me now to this other topic, which is related and yet very different, which is Venezuela. Yeah, people listening to you might think, oh, here's someone who fled Cuba, and he's part of that movement, and he's from Cuba. But actually, you're not. You're from Venezuela, and that was your school of hard knocks. You actually tussled with the regime of the late Hugo Chavez. You sat down with Chavez for dialogue, didn't work, and then you left, and now you're considered an enemy of that regime.
Well, yes. I didn't start out to be an enemy of the regime. I just started out trying to fight for civil liberties and freedom of action in economics. I was the head of a trade group in Venezuela, the head of the Confederation of Industries in Venezuela when Chavez became president. And initially, I had a very good relation with Chavez. I had many conversations with him. And of course, Chavez was a moderate, you can say, a moderate leftist for the first 3 years, because his plan was he didn't want to rock the boat economically until he controlled all the levers of power.
Mm-hmm.
He first had to control the National Assembly. He had to control the judicial system, the army, and so forth. As he controlled all the levers of power of the state, then he became more and more radical. That was the process.
Oh.
But initially, he was very moderate because he was a very smart man. And as you said, I talked to him, and I, you know, the clownish Chavez that people saw on television was a show he put on because it was popular. It made him popular.
Mm-hmm.
But he was actually a brilliant man.
Unfortunately,
a brilliant man. So he had his plan very well laid out from the beginning.
And yet, we were talking about the Cuban disaster and sort of going over that because a lot of people have forgotten about it. But in Venezuela, the disaster is fresh in everybody's minds. Venezuela had one of the highest standards of living in the world, proven oil reserves that rivaled those of Saudi Arabia.
Actually, more over Saudi Arabia. Our proven reserves are larger than Saudi Arabia's.
All the more incredible. I mean, it had all those assets. It was the jewel of the South American continent, and he squandered it.
Absolutely. It didn't start with Chavez. I mean, Venezuela was a case of, I would say the break point came in 1973, with Pérez, the so-called social democrats. They veered to the left. Venezuela was the first oil shock of the 73-74 oil shock. The government of Venezuela at that time, they were true democrats, I have to say. These people were true democrats, but they were very leftist and very statist in their ideas. They decided they could do away with the private sector.
Hmm.
We have all this oil money. The price of oil quadrupled in 1973-74. So actually, Carlos Andrés Pérez gave a speech saying that we don't need the private sector anymore. The state can do it all. And that's the central bank, which was independent, was nationalized. Foreign investments was limited to a few areas in the economy. The rest were either nationalized or forced to sell to locals. The aluminum industry was nationalized. The mines were nationalized.
Long before Chavez.
This started to happen in 1974. So by 1999, when Chavez is elected, you had a country that should have been very rich, and had been very rich. It had been the richest by far in Latin America, into a country in crisis. And that's why Chavez, that first election, 1998, that Chavez won, it was a free election, and Chavez won it fair and square because the country had been already on the road to ruin since 1974.
And at what point did you and others become exiles? At what point did you decide, well, we can only defend our ideas from North America, we have to leave?
Well, I would say wrongly accused. I mean, the government at one point accused me of civil rebellion and treason in Venezuela, so I had to leave.
Did you leave in a hurry? Okay. Yeah, did you leave like that 5 to 12?
Yeah. So Chavez eventually, in one of the electoral years, he decided, you know, we weren't really true enemies of the regime, and the charges were dropped. But that's the original reason why I moved. And then I decided to stay here and stay in the United States, and I even became an American citizen. Because, unfortunately, I see it's going to take over a generation to restore Venezuela to where it was in 1998, the year that Chavez was elected. The country is in ruins. You have a country on the border of becoming a failed state. And I have children, and I wanted my children to have a good future in freedom. And that's the reason why I stayed.
And this might be like comparing pestilence and cholera, but let's compare them. Cuba and Venezuela, is one worse than the other, or are they basically the same thing?
No, I think Cuba is much worse. Venezuela hasn't gotten there yet. I mean, we have an authoritarian regime with political prisoners, as in Cuba, but first of all, it's the number of political prisoners is insignificant to the one in Cuba. We don't have the sophisticated repression, Stalinist repression, that the Cubans have yet. There is still an opposition that is allowed to do some opposition to a certain extent. If you become too popular like Leopoldo López, the government invents a charge and puts you in prison. But generally, it's an authoritarian regime, not yet totalitarian. Cuba is a Stalinist totalitarian regime that has not changed at all just because President Obama decided to reestablish relations.
Are you free to travel to Venezuela? Do you go back?
Yes, I've gone back. I go back.
And are you nervous when you land?
No. I used to be. Not anymore. I'm not involved in politics in Venezuela. I'm a critic of the government, of course, but I've never been actually involved in politics. I was always trying to, let's say, fight in terms of Chavez, fight laws against laws that were, for example, confiscating property without payment and that kind of stuff. I became an enemy because we became too vocal. We organized protests. We organized a national strike against Chavez because there's the other thing nobody talks about. I remember when the American press was very favorable of Chavez a few years ago. Nobody reported on the fact that there was a lot of persecution going on to the union, the head of the unions. Most of the Venezuelan union leadership is in exile.
Ah, I see.
And we actually, when we, the business community, organized a strike, the unions came to us and said, we want to join you on that strike.
That's incredible.
So, and that's a story that is not known, how Chavez persecuted all the union leadership, the traditional union leadership of Venezuela, with 2 million members in the unions. They were destroyed. They don't exist anymore. Now you have Chavista, you have government unions.
Yeah, of course.
All unions are government unions now. In the south of Venezuela, where the steel mills and the aluminum mills are, there's actually, I mean, if you pick up any newspaper, still report about the killings and the violence against any worker that tries to form an independent union in those areas.
Final question. Nikita Khrushchev once told the Western world, we will bury you. He was talking about communism. And the East Germans in East Berlin used to put up signs on their buildings for the West Germans to read, the West Berliners, mocking capitalism. We know what happened with all that. Will these two regimes inevitably collapse?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I hope that the Venezuelan regime doesn't take 60 or 70 years, as in Cuba. They have been 16 years in power already. But those regimes, I mean, look at the old Soviet Union. Look at Russia today, a country where you were pretty much harassed if you went to church, if you went to mass, as a Christian, you were literally harassed. And now you go to Russia, and churches are bursting with people after 70 years of official atheism. Now the churches are back and are full. These are unnatural regimes. These are regimes that go against human nature.
Yes.
And they all go the way that the Soviet Union did.
Well, Luis Enrique Ball, I'm convinced you and I will have a Cuba Libre together one day. And long life, good luck, and congratulations on the Pan Am Post and on your principal stance.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Luis Enrique Ball, publisher of the Pan Am Post, was our guest this week on Free Markets, the Fiera series of the World Show. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.